I generally find when I talk to entrepreneurs and founders and people in the business world, I find that they underestimate or don't even consider the emotional component of what they're doing, when actually, like, emotion is extremely practical. Like, if your work is fun or you're excited about it or you believe very deeply in it, it's an accelerant for everything. You're going to be able to work longer. You're going to be more resilient when problems show up. You're going to problem solve better. You're going to recruit talent easier. You know, everything is going to get 10, 20, 30% easier if you're emotionally aligned with what you're doing. And I just find that so many people don't, they just try to bury it. They try not to think about it.
This episode is brought to you by my friends at Whoop. Yes, the Whoop strap is one of my favorite pieces of tech. Get real-time feedback on your sleep, training, recovery, and health, plus in-app coaching features to help you optimize performance. Sleep better, train smarter, recover faster, feel healthier, manage your stress. It's all there in the Whoop app on the Whoop strap. Just go to my special link at join.whoop.com/behindthebrand and get a great price and a new Whoop strap. All right, let's get back to the show.
My name is Mark Manson. I am an author, podcaster, and YouTuber, and I'm on Behind the Brand with Brian Elliott.
Everyone, welcome to another episode of the show. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I usually ask my guests, how did you get this job?
On accident? Just kind of like, I sometimes say I Forrest Gump my way into it.
Super relatable. Yeah. Say more about that.
Yeah. As most good careers, I think it sort of happens. You stumble into it. In 2007, 2008, I'd just gotten out of school, worst job market in 100 years. And I read Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek. Mm-hmm. And my immediate thought was, that sounds easy. I'll make an e-commerce website. How hard can it be? Jump ahead 2 to 3 years. It turns out that I was a pretty mediocre e-commerce entrepreneur. But at the time, the way you got traffic to your e-commerce website was by blogging. And
right.
So I started blogs for all my different websites to try to accumulate traffic. And what I discovered is that I was actually pretty good at the blogging part and pretty mediocre at the e-commerce part. So I eventually, around 2010, I decided to kind of go all in on the blogging and the writing, and the rest is history.
What sort of signals did you get? I mean, you're sort of inferring that the e-commerce wasn't doing great, the blogging, what were the signals? Like, more traffic, more comment, more engagement, less sales? Like, how did you know? And I ask that with context, because a lot of people who watch and listen to the show, I think let's put them in two buckets. There's a bucket of folks that are maybe just coming out of school and they're trying to figure out what they should do. Should they pursue what they're good at, or, you know, what they think is a good idea? And there's a whole other bucket of people, maybe let's say, you know, mid-career, mm-hmm. and they went to law school, they're miserable, and they just want to hit the reset button.
Yeah.
And so I'm sort of asking in a way, like, how do you find that thing that you should be doing, your true calling?
I think the first step is experimentation. You know, you have to try things, and you don't really know if this is it until you've actually tried it a little bit. The analogy or the metaphor that I always use with people is that when you put more effort into some things, it feels like pushing a rock up a hill. Like, the more you push, the harder it gets. Whereas there are other things that it's like pushing a rock down a hill. Like, mm-hmm. the more you push, the easier it gets. And you want to look for the things that get easier the more you push on them. And so what I personally experienced is that sales and marketing doesn't come naturally to me. It was a pretty steep learning curve, and I don't think I have a knack for it. So I'm okay at it, but it was like pushing a rock up a hill.
Yeah.
It was like, for every extra ounce of effort, there was marginal gain. Mm-hmm. Whereas the writing, it felt like the more I invested in it, the more time I spent on putting together articles, the more time I spent researching, the easier it got and the better, the more exponential result I got from it. And so I just realized over time that that's probably what I should be putting all my effort into.
I like that advice a lot. I think, the other thing I would say is, I think you've got to try a lot of things on that don't fit.
Yes.
It's a process of elimination, and that you shouldn't feel bad if something you try it on, you think that's going to look great on me. And then it like, oh, the crotch is too tight.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah,
yeah. This is not it.
Yeah.
You know,
I think it's not only true, is it, you know, cross profession or cross career choice, but it's also, I believe, true within a profession or a business. So, you know, if you are running, I don't know, a restaurant or something, right? Like there's going to be some things that you try that it feels like a rock going down a hill.
Yeah.
And there's going to be some things that you try that it's going to feel like a rock going up a hill. And so you, even within the business itself, even within like from product to product or vertical to vertical or marketing strategy to marketing strategy, some things are just going to have very little resistance and give you exponential results. And some are going to generate a lot of resistance. And I think the trap that people fall into is that the more resistance they experience, their ego gets involved and they start thinking, they're like, oh, I'm not going to give up. I'm going to be the one who powers through it. And it's mm-hmm. like, it's actually like, no, that's actually the wrong move. You want to find where your natural advantages lie and where your special talents and abilities lie. And the thing that has less resistance is actually going to be the thing that points towards that.
Yeah. Let me ask a follow-up, which is, okay, so you go down this path. Let's see, let's stay in restaurants for a second. Your restaurant's going great. Then all of a sudden, you know, the foot traffic isn't what it used to be.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes there's little life cycles within businesses that are doing great. And you have to sort of reinvent yourself. And, you know, Seth Godin might call it the dip. Like some of us start something and then there's this dip and then you got to know. So how do you know whether to weather that storm, mm-hmm. you know, push through and keep making that pasta dish that, well, we used to sell the heck out of that.
Yeah.
And now it doesn't sell anymore. Why aren't people eating that anymore? Versus like, okay, we need to reset the menu.
Right.
Or maybe it's the, we need to reupholster the chairs. Like, how do you know how long to give that great idea?
I think the dip is a great point to bring up, because I think sometimes what happens is those things flip. I'll give an example from my career.
Please.
You know, blogging was from 2007 to, blogging's kind of dead today, right? Like it's there are niche Substacks and people who are still doing it at a modest level, but like the days of massive blogs that generate millions and millions of page views,
yeah,
they're kind of long gone. But
they used to be what started the whole influencer movement. I mean,
absolutely.
If you were blogging back in, you know, 2003 or four,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you could amass a following.
Yeah. I mean, my blog from 2012 to 2015 was doing 5 to 10 million page views per month.
Yeah.
Right. And like, that's a really good living.
It's
not really possible anymore though. So what happened is probably around 2015, 2016, the social media platforms decided to start limiting reach and limiting your exposure essentially for
right.
free. So it started to become more of a pay for play model.
Yeah.
And that just killed blog traffic. And suddenly this thing that had felt like pushing a boulder down a hill for 5 years, suddenly started to feel like pushing a boulder up a hill.
Mm-hmm. Things change.
It absolutely. The market environment changes.
Yeah. In fact, you expect it to change.
Yes. The landscape literally, to keep this metaphor going, the landscape changes.
Mm-hmm.
And so what used to be downhill is now uphill.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, if you've been going downhill for a while, it's like it takes a few years to realize now you're going uphill for that resistance to start to kick in.
Right.
And so I realized probably 4 or 5 years ago, like, I need to pivot. This is a dead end.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to start thinking of other ways to distribute content or produce content.
Yeah. You're right. There's some denial that takes place.
Yes.
Some bargaining.
Yeah.
Well, it's probably this or that.
Yeah.
But then, you know. You just know.
We just had a bad year. It's going to be fine.
Right.
But yeah.
And then it keeps repeating.
Right.
Then maybe you know.
Yeah.
It's time to pivot or.
But I think a lot of that comes down to being able to zoom out honestly and have perspective on just the world and the market circumstances. And, you know, it eventually became undeniable of like, people don't want to leave TikTok. They don't want to leave Instagram. Like nobody wants to click a link anymore, right?
Yeah.
And it takes so much effort to get them to click that it doesn't make sense to send them to like a blog post.
Yeah. People live in the ecosystems where they're comfortable.
Yes.
Okay. So then where did that take you? So you made a pivot. You decided mm-hmm. that wasn't working. This is 2010. I mean, just for context for people who maybe don't remember that era. I mean, you're at iPhone 3.
Yeah.
iPhone number 3.
Yeah.
YouTube is about 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
The internet is barely a decade. I mean, it's a decade plus, mm-hmm. some change. What did you do from there?
I realized that writing was my advantage. And I think I made another observation around the same time that was pretty crucial, which was that Facebook had just launched its newsfeed. And when I looked at that, I thought really hard about it. And I realized that Facebook basically wanted to become the homepage for everyone in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
It wanted you to get your news there, get your celebrity gossip there, to get your family updates there. Any publication you might read or be interested in, Facebook wanted to be the place that you went for that.
And all be all.
So they were juicing, and most mainstream publishing had not recognized this. And a lot of mainstream publications weren't even on Facebook yet. So I looked at that and I realized that Facebook is really juicing the algorithm for like a good piece of viral written content.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could just get really good at coming up with a clickable title and a clever image under it, and then also deliver on like a really high value article that people liked a lot, it's game over. And so I started executing on that in 2012, and basically my audience went from maybe 10 or 20,000 to 2 to 3 million people within a couple of years.
On Facebook.
Primarily Facebook,
Yeah. And what was that article? What was it? Was it something close to The Subtle Art, or what was it?
So it's funny. I actually had a series. I probably had 10 or 15 viral articles over that period. And Subtle Art was actually one of the last ones. The first one was actually, I was living abroad at the time. So I wrote an article called 10 Things Most Americans Don't Know About America. And it was kind of writing about American culture from an outsider's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And that one went absolutely bananas. I got invited on all sorts of like political talk radio show. I'm like, I don't give a shit about politics. I just wanted to write about, you know, culture.
Were you in South America, Central America? Where were you?
I was in Colombia at the time.
Okay.
Yeah. But then most of them, you know, I had a relationships article called The Law of Fuck Yes or No. I had one that was like 7 Strange Questions to Find Your Life Purpose. There's a whole series of them, probably about 10 or 12 of them.
Yeah.
And then The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck was one of the last ones. I think maybe the second to last one before Facebook turned off the spigot. And that was the most successful one.
Mm-hmm. Put a timestamp on that. Like, what age were you when you had that first virality?
The first virality happened, I was 27.
Okay.
And I remember this was back when blogs had comments and you actually read the comments. Mm-hmm. it feels like a different era, but I remember I got 3,000 comments in a single day. And I remember actually, because back then I used to actually try to read all my comments and respond to people.
As one does.
And I remember just like, it was one of the most emotionally stressful afternoons of my life, like actually trying to go through all those comments. And I finally, it took a few hours, but I finally realized like, what are you doing? Like, you shouldn't even be looking at these things. But it was virality back then. It hadn't really existed before, or it existed, but it wasn't so quantifiable, mm-hmm. you know, like it used to be much more informal. Things would go viral, but it was mostly through word of mouth. And then people would just kind of share a URL through an email or something.
Yeah. And videos were picking up traction on YouTube, you know, things were happening in the video space.
Yeah.
But not the written word.
No.
Yeah.
I think it was the first time, though, like early 2010s was the first time that like as a cultural, like you could look at some, like Facebook would show the share numbers and the like numbers and everything. So it was the first time that there was like a public awareness of, oh, that went viral.
Yeah. It popped.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've heard you talk offline about your experience, but share that with the audience who don't know that story. So what got you to Colombia? What resulted in you traveling abroad?
So that was also part of the 4-hour work week. And in the 4-hour work week, Tim Ferriss talks about how you can set up a small business online and then arbitrage. He called it geo arbitrage. So it's basically like go find a part of the world that the quality of life is close or similar to the United States, yeah. but the cost of living is a fraction, right?
Yeah. So he literally took his advice.
Yeah, I lived out the whole book.
Yeah. Had you ever met Tim or?
Yeah, I have a couple times.
Before that though?
Oh, no.
So you're just a guy who bought his book.
And actually did it.
Applied the principles.
One of the few who actually went and did it. Yeah.
But I'm just thinking, trying to get in your head a little bit. I mean, this is sort of what I assume authors wish would happen.
Yeah.
You've written your book.
Sure.
And it's had enormous success. And you're hoping that people will literally take a page from it and put it into practice, right?
Well, and I know how hard that is. Like, I joke about it, but it's... I've read plenty of books that I like the advice and I don't do it. I completely ignore it. And it is hard to implement advice, but I think part of it was I was at a point in my life. I mean, one was traveling the world had always been a dream of mine. And prior to that book, it never seemed feasible or practical. So that book opened my eyes to the fact like, oh, if you can start a website or a business online, you can go wherever you want. You can live wherever you want. So like that was extremely exciting for me as a young person. And then, like I said, you know, it was 2007, 2008, like there are no freaking jobs anywhere. So if I'm going to be broke, I might as well be broke starting a website.
Yeah. So you gave it a go for, you know, a year or two, and then you get inspired by this book and then you go abroad for another couple of years. Okay. And then what happened?
So I was actually, I lived abroad for 6 years in total, and it eventually hit a point where it was clear for my career to progress, I needed to come back. Like it became very clear that by not being in the United States, I was missing out on a lot of networking opportunities,
sure.
publishing deals, things like this, mm-hmm. you know? When we started pitching publishers, my agent and I in 2015, and when it was clear that book that was being pitched later became Subtle Art, when it was clear that was going to be a big book deal, I remember talking. She's now my wife, but at the time she was my girlfriend, and it was like I should be in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to you getting an agent. A lot of people dream about having representation, and
yeah.
What was the delta between that viral post on Facebook and you getting an agent?
It was a few years, but back then it was a relatively new thing. So mm-hmm. today it's standard practice. It's mm-hmm. almost, I mean, I'm going to be very blunt. People don't like hearing this. People like the idea that, you know, that if they have a brilliant book idea or a brilliant manuscript, like that's going to get them a book deal. But in this day and age, it's most publishers, and this is true in music, it's becoming true in Hollywood. Like they want to see proof of concept.
Oh yeah.
They want to see a social following. They want to see that, you know, you have 100,000 followers on Instagram and they actually read your stuff and they like it and it travels, it gets shared.
Mm-hmm. They're chicken shit.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you can't blame them, right? It's like, it's free market testing for them. And they can just scoop up like whatever wins, they just go scoop it up.
Yeah.
But I mean, on the creative side as well, I also think it's a good thing because it allows you to market test your ideas. Like we all think we have a brilliant book idea, but the fact is 9 out of 10 or 99 out of 100 of our ideas are not very good. Right. And so instead of investing years of your life on an idea that is potentially actually not very good, you can actually go online and just find out instantaneously whether it's a good idea or not.
Right.
You can also hone your craft as well, which this is another thing that I don't think a lot of writers realize is that unless you're just like a prodigious talent, you're not going to come out of the gate a really great writer. You need to hone and refine your voice and your skills over time. And the best way to do that is with a small engaged audience,
mm-hmm.
you know, a steady stream of people who read your stuff, offer feedback, offer criticism, point out things that you missed, point out things that you haven't thought of. And then over the course of 2, 3, 4 years, you know, really develop a strong voice and a handful of really, really strong ideas.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about Hemingway, right? He had to go to Spain. He had to go to war.
Yeah.
He had to experience everything in the field that he was writing about.
He was also a journalist for like 15 years before he wrote a novel. And you know, he probably had an obnoxious editor telling him constantly, like, this is shit, delete that, you know?
he did. And he also had F. Scott Fitzgerald giving him feedback.
Yeah.
Saying, hey, buddy, you know, you might consider this versus that. And, and then mix that with all the drinking and cavorting he did. That's, you know, that's how you get the chaos.
that's the magic formula.
That's apparently, of course, it ended badly, but
yeah, of course,
that's not always, that's maybe not a good path.
Yeah.
But
I think there's a tendency in all creative fields that you see the public awareness of somebody only happens, towards the tail end of the work that goes into the thing. And it's, you don't see the years and years and years of like workshopping ideas and honing talent, honing your voice, honing your craft.
Yeah.
And it's that used to happen, you know, in writers' workshops and weekend retreats. And now it happens on Substack and Twitter and Instagram.
Yeah, that's what they call them, the 15-year overnight success, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes you get lucky. You know, you create a website called thefacebook.com.
Yeah.
And it goes nuts right out of the gate. That's the anomaly, right? Other people just have to work it out, audition it, like you said. So you get the agent. You start talking about this book. I'm always curious about the naming convention because, you know, we live in this YouTube world. We live in this world where we want more clicks and engagement, just so people can discover the work that we're making.
Yeah.
Even have a chance to have it discovered. What was that exercise like, thinking about the titles for that book?
It's funny because I actually wrote probably half of that book with different titles in mind. And then it was, after I had written about half of the draft, I wrote the article, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. And that just blew up so hard and so aggressively that to me, it was just obvious that that should be the title of the book. You know, it was I had a conversation with my agent at the time and she was like, this should be the title. Like, let's be honest, this should be the title.
Yeah.
And so maybe try to fit that in, make that chapter one and then, you know, edit everything else to kind of flow from it. And that's what I did. But in terms of your question about titles, so this actually ties back into the e-commerce thing, which is when I was studying marketing and sales, trying to get these tiny, crappy e-commerce businesses to work, I studied a lot of copywriting. And at the time, I was kind of grossed out by it. I'm like, ah, these headlines, they're so cheesy, you know?
Clickbaity.
Yeah, very clickbaity.
Yeah, you know? The BuzzFeed era.
It's like the weird essence that can solve your, you know, hip problems for good. It's just, your soul kind of dies inside.
Discover the fountain of youth.
Yeah. It's you just want to crawl into a hole.
Yeah. When you feel dirty.
When you write some of this stuff. But it was those skills that when I started focusing on virality on Facebook, that they kind of came back into use. Because it's like, okay, I need like titles really, really matter on this platform. And so I need to just hit a home run as often as possible. And so I started a copywriting practice, which was, you know, in copywriting, they teach you, don't just write one headline, write like 20 or 30 headlines, and then take the five best and then iterate on those and then take the one best, like the one best, you know, because you're the first headline is never going to be the best one.
Yeah.
And I started applying that to title. So every article I wrote, I would come up with like 20, 25 different titles. And that turned out to be a really, really good exercise because it just got me very, very good at writing titles and understanding what gets people's attention, what gets people to stop and think for a second. And so by the time, you know, the Subtle Art article came out, I've been playing that game at a pretty high level for 3 or 4 years. And it just logically translates into the book world as well.
What were some of the alternative titles that you considered that were runner up or maybe top five?
I remember there was one, it was something like happiness is not enough, or stop trying to be happy. One was like, I remember I had one that my editor really liked, but he was like, nobody's going to buy that. I had one, it was, the title was just ... and then you die. And, you know, there was some dark humor mixed in there, but originally a lot of the titles revolved around happiness. Mm-hmm. Because that was kind of the hot topic back then. It was like every book coming out was, you know, the happiness equation or the happiness hypothesis or the key to happiness. And I wanted to do something that kind of went counter to that. It was like, you know, happiness is not enough, or happiness is overrated, or stop trying to be happy, mm-hmm. something like that. So a lot of those ideas are still in the book. Like you get to chapter 2, 3, 4, 5, most of it's about how happiness is overrated, mm-hmm. but it's all now framed through a not giving a fuck lens.
Yeah. Do you see this more as a franchise then?
No. There's definitely been a lot of questioning over the years about that. Obviously, my publisher very vocally wanted to push me into, you know, subtle art of not giving a fuck for kids, subtle art of not giving a fuck for pregnant women, yeah. subtle art of not giving a fuck for teachers, you know, it, like, let's just spin this out. Let's do chicken soup for the soul for
right.
non-fuck givers. I look at that and I'm like, okay, that would be, yes, it would be very lucrative. I just couldn't really bring myself. It just wasn't creatively interesting.
Yeah, it's a sellout to a cop out.
It's totally a sellout. Yeah. It's you're turning it into, you're turning it into like a corporation at that point, which is fine. Like, I mean, it's like nothing against Chicken Soup for the Soul or other book franchises that have done that. But like, I just realized that like that wasn't really going to make me that happy.
Yeah. And that's maybe a good segue into this idea that I ask a lot of people about, which, you know, this show is called Behind the Brand. Mm-hmm. We talk a lot about brand, like what it is, why it's important. Let me ask you, what your definition of a brand is, and then tell me what the Mark Manson brand is.
It's a great question.
This episode is brought to you by WeWork. Being able to work remotely is a game changer. You don't have to spend time and money commuting, and often you can work from anywhere in the world. But it does have its downsides. It can be pretty lonely working from home, and if you're off traveling, it can be really hard to find somewhere to sit down and work without a sticky table. That's where WeWork comes in. WeWork is co-working space with offices all over the world. They have everything you need: fast Wi-Fi, free tea and coffee, and loads of desk space and meeting rooms, so you always have somewhere to get your work done, whether that's alone or with friends and co-workers. And with WeWork On Demand, you can book co-working space by the day and meeting rooms by the hour at locations all around the world. Thanks to our friends at WeWork, you can get 50% off your next co-working space booking. Head to we.co/Brian50. That's B-R-Y-A-N 50. Download the WeWork app and enter code B-R-Y-A-N 50. That's Brian 50 to get 50% off your next booking. Here we go.
And I'd love to talk about the F word.
Yeah.
Because this is something that I still struggle with today.
Okay. You can drop bombs here. It's all good.
No, but I mean, as it relates to my brand.
Yeah. Because it can be polarizing.
It is very polarizing, yeah. and on a lot of different dimensions. But to answer your question, okay, what is a brand? I would say a brand is how people... the associations that people identify you with, both consciously and unconsciously, in their mm-hmm. mind. It's both what they associate with you intellectually, you know, like, oh, Apple makes computers, they have great phones, but also emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
It's very clean, sleek, professional, you know, sophisticated. And then what is the Mark Manson brand? It's really funny you're asking this because my team and I were currently in the early stages of a brand pivot. And so we've been asking this question a lot ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I just wrote out, I'm not even kidding you, like 3 days ago, like the core, like the pillars of the Mark Manson brand. So yeah. The first one was Relatability. I think it was smart, funny, relatability, and non-judgmental. So it's life advice that is intelligent, it's well-researched. It's also delivered in a funny, entertaining manner. It's very relatable. It's like a guy in a bar just talking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a professor. I'm not like a billionaire.
Not a PhD. You don't have your psychology degree.
No letters after my name. And it's also, it's non-judgmental. Like there's a lot of life advice out there that kind of moralizes, or gets political.
Mm-hmm.
And I strongly believe that to help the most people, you should kind of zoom out as much as possible and be as compassionate as possible. Like understand people come from all different walks of life and mm-hmm. I don't necessarily know what's best for them.
That resonates with me too. That non-judgmental part though, does that come from experience? Like maybe there was a time when you had a lot of judgment, you know, religious upbringing or, you know, whatever your...
Well, so this ties into the polarization thing. So the answer is no. I've always been a very non-judgmental person. And I think that's, in my personal life, that's been a very good thing. In the current media environment, it's gotten very difficult for me because judgment polarizes audiences.
Mm-hmm.
It creates very intense engagement and fans on one side, and it creates very intense criticism and engagement on the other side.
Right.
And so being non-judgmental is actually kind of a suboptimal content strategy in the 2020s.
Yeah, you're sort of Switzerland.
Exactly.
You're neutral. You're neither this nor that.
And who gets excited about Switzerland?
Like, right.
Everybody gets, you know, you get excited about Russia or Israel or Gaza. Like nobody's like, you know, out protesting in the streets over Switzerland and their neutrality. So that's been a little bit of a challenge, or it's just raised a lot of questions. The other thing is the word fuck. It has been such a blessing and such a curse over the years. And I've gone both ways year by year, month by month, day by day of like being so grateful for it and really owning it. And then other times just wanting to disavow it and just be done with it. People, even today, even after, like, there's so much fuck content out there. There's so many fuck books. There's so many, like, you go on Instagram, there's so many copycats, people right. saying, you know, here's not how not to give a fuck. You, to this day, it just happened last week. You add fuck to the title or the first line of a piece of content, and it immediately, the engagement goes up like 20-30%. Like it just,
right.
the people who like it, love it. Right. And they really, really engage with it. And I'm very fortunate that I was one of the first or the first person in my industry to like really lean into that word. Like I kind of own that word in my industry.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, it's a cheat code, right? Like it's, I should leverage that. And I do. On the other hand, there are costs that come with it. So there's a lot, obviously a lot of people don't like it and they judge and criticize and send angry emails.
Yeah. There's a whole part of America that would probably just say, just tune out. Like,
yes,
can't do it.
But there's also some more subtle costs, which I didn't realize until, you know, maybe a few years ago. For instance, this is not complaining.
This is a function of a decision you made.
Yes.
This is why branding is so important.
It's super important.
To talk about. Yeah.
Yeah. It's insanely important.
Things cut both ways.
They do. And you have to have a strong brand, you have to polarize. And
yeah.
And you have to be aware. And I think this is, I guess, if I was to make a complaint, I was not fully aware of the dimensions that I was polarizing on. The dimension I was aware of was like, when I put fuck in the title of an article, it goes more viral. And I get more negative comments.
Right.
I can live with that because I want the virality, right? What I didn't realize, especially once I had a best-selling book out and, you know, I was doing lots of media, there are, so corporate, anything corporate related, like they don't come near me.
Right.
Right. So I have peers who have books that have sold a tenth of the copies, and they are loaded up on the corporate circuit, you know, doing conferences and
keynotes
and consulting and like making crazy amounts of money. And I just never get those calls. Another example is media, right? There's some publications that just, doesn't matter how popular I am, they just won't talk to me.
Yeah.
And then there's also, there's a certain, I think there's a little bit of a stereotyping that happens with people who are not familiar with my work. When they're first exposed to it, they assume that it's, I mean, it is a little bit lowbrow, but I mean, they assume that it's not as thoughtful and researched as it is. I often hear from people who say, when I first saw your book, I thought it was just a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah.
And then after like six people told me to read it, I read it and wow, it's actually really smart. Like that, it's actually really smart phrase kills me a little bit inside.
Yeah. You know, that's, it's interesting you say that because I hear that from comedians.
Yeah.
They'll say like, you know, like back in the day, Eddie Murphy, which is like full of profanity.
Yeah.
Hilarious. But like, you look at someone like Nate Bargatze or Bargatze. Mm-hmm. I just went to see him at Hollywood Bowl. He's hilarious.
Yeah.
The guy doesn't swear.
Yeah.
He's still afraid of his parents. Judgment.
Yeah.
But that's part of his shtick, right? But it's like, no, I get it. It's tougher to not use the kind of language that get people juiced up.
Yeah.
So I can understand that misjudgment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been... I think, I mean, obviously overall it's net positive and I'm generally happy to be associated with it, but it's been, again, I wasn't aware of some of the costs or drawbacks that would emerge later on in my career.
Yeah, no, it's well said. I think a brand it's got to be, and I don't think it has to be polarizing mm-hmm. in my opinion. I think it has to be distinct.
Okay.
And a brand is like a shorthand for what you stand for.
Yeah.
Right? If I think about like seeing a James Bond movie, I kind of know what I'm going to expect.
Yep.
There's going to be some shaking and not stirred. There's going to be some handguns, nice cars, pretty people.
Tuxedos,
maybe some gambling.
Yeah.
Some violence. Mm-hmm. You kind of know what you're going to get before you even see, you even hear the movie plot. You don't need to see the trailer.
Yeah.
You've got this image. And so I think, when you have a brand versus when you have a product or a commodity, right? Like that's the difference.
Yeah.
And then I think there's also brands that are, you know, they'll hang a marquee up like Marriott hotels, mm-hmm. right? That brand is meant to be ubiquitous, like on every street corner and you've got affordable options and maybe something with a kitchen. But it's like, you know, when it's not distinct, like, I don't think Marriott is distinct.
Right.
You're in danger of this sort by price.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, well, if there's a Hilton next door, I'll just go there because it's either, you know, $150 there or $129
$10
there.
Cheaper. Yeah.
And so that's the danger of not being distinct. Mm-hmm. Right. And so once you pick a path, like I'm the subtle art of not giving a fuck and you say it with confidence, then that is what it is. That's the trail that you're blazing.
Yeah.
You can always change it, but it's like, you know, a lot of things then become inevitable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been interesting because I think it is when I look at it compared to some of my peers or similar brands in my industry, I think what has happened is that I've built a larger, I don't want to call it low quality, but like larger, younger, lower price point audience. And I think it probably nets out roughly the same as the alternative. You know, the fuck generally appeals to younger people. But they're not looking for like, you know, a $2,000 consulting seminar or to hire you to come in and talk to their executive team.
Yeah.
But you're going to reach a lot of them.
Yeah, I guess it's that is that time in their life, right? Where you're trying to figure stuff out. It's anti-establishment.
Yeah.
It's fuck the man.
Yeah.
Or you're getting fucked by the man.
Yeah.
so you're like, yeah, I mean,
yeah,
fuck it all, right?
Yeah.
Like you're just on board with all the fucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. It makes sense. Tracks.
Yeah.
And, but you know, you are maybe seeding a generation of younger people who then come up and if they do consume your product, you know, your, the written word or other ideas that you've got, videos, then you can keep them in your community.
Yeah.
And there's stuff to do with them.
It is interesting. I do think it offends less than it did 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We've definitely seen that. I mean, we still get complaints here and there, but not nearly to the same degree as we did 10 years ago. Like it seemed the edge of the word has kind of been blunted a little bit over time, which again kind of brings that polarization in a little bit. Like it's not as shocking anymore, so we don't see the same kind of reach that we used to, but at the same time, it's not as distinguishing or distinct as it used to be.
Yeah. Can I tell you what I think the Mark Manson brand is?
Sure.
Because I think one of the other definitions or byproducts of when you start a brand is that once you, like, hey, I made this for you, or I made this in general, once it leaves your hands and goes into the world, then it belongs to the world.
Yeah.
And the world gets to make their interpretation of every touch point they have with you. So some people might have a really good experience, some people might not. And then that's what lives in the hearts and minds of the people. And so you might have many hundreds, thousands, millions of interpretations of your brand.
Mm-hmm.
The key is to like have it aligned with the walk and the talk, right?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I bought your book like everyone else.
Sure.
Enjoyed it. Totally thought it was something different when I bought it.
Yeah.
And I think maybe at the time I was mad at the world or like feeling like the world was unfair and bad things were happening to me. And so I bought it like, all right, I'm going to read this. And then it was something totally different. But, I think your book is about clarity.
Mm-hmm.
It's about like seeing your life and the world for what it really is. And also it's sort of an invitation to make it what you want it to be versus having you be. Let's see. Let's pick the right words. So instead of being acted upon, you take action.
Yes. Empowerment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting you brought those things up. So as part of this kind of brand pivot that we're doing, it's really actually ironic because we were supposed to do this like 4 months ago and schedules got this got delayed forever. So it is quite a coincidence that we're doing this now. But we've, as part of it, we surveyed the team that, of what they think the Mark Manson brand is. And one of my employees said that, as he said, it's helping people confront reality and see maybe the things that they didn't really want to see before. And I think that's where the humor comes in, is if you can make them laugh a little bit, you can show them something unpleasant about themselves or the world.
Yeah. It makes the medicine go down a little easier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, it's interesting that you said that. It's same ballpark that we're in. I don't know, like the fuck word, I don't know how much to bang that drum. Like I keep feeling like for years now, I'm like, this has got to get old at some point, you know, like this is at some point, this is going to feel like, you know, a cliche or, you know, like a trend that ran its course.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like there's like a mini clap track behind it every time you say it. It's like a little, you know, like.
Yeah. I don't know. It's, I never expect again, going back to that decision with my agent. It was at the time, it just seemed like such a simple one. And I remember actually we had conversations with the publisher because back then they didn't publish profanity in titles or on covers because there are a lot of stores you couldn't get into.
Right.
And My Books was one of, actually might have been the first one with profanity that like Walmart carried and Target carried. And
well, it wasn't exactly spelled out, right? You had the splash.
Yeah.
You know, so it was.
But even that, like, I mean, I remember apparently the publisher went back and forth with Walmart for like a year before. Like it was number one in the New York Times for like months before Walmart finally relented and said,
yeah,
okay, we'll put it in our stores.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it was interesting. I remember having the conversation with the publisher and they were like, look, you know, on the one hand, my agent and I were like, this is winning so hard online that we'd be kind of dumb not to use it. And the publisher was like, yeah, but.
This episode is also brought to you by my friends at Plunge. Some of you know that when I met Wim Hof, the Iceman, he was instrumental in helping me cure my chronic migraines with cold therapy. I first discovered cold plunging on my journey to better health about 3 years ago. I was getting pretty serious migraine headaches from a combination of poor sleep habits, inflammatory foods, work-related stress, and dehydration. I had no idea what was going on. I was miserable, couldn't function at work or home, and none of my doctors could figure out how to solve my problem without addictive pain meds. I started slowly with cold showers and immediately felt the benefits. I knew I needed to take it to the next level and started cold plunging. I focused on optimizing my sleep, fitness, nutrition, and it all started coming together. I have probably saved over $20,000 in medical bills staying healthy and fit on this protocol. How much would you invest to feel amazing? For me, the investment in a cold plunge to feel like me again was priceless. I've lost weight, I'm more mentally awake and don't need coffee or Red Bulls, and I'm doing my best to live a longer, healthier life to be with my family. That's what I want. My friends at Plunge just released the all-new, all-in unit, which is totally redesigned and full of upgrades. Use my code BRY, that's B-R-Y, to get a better price when you buy it. Just go to plunge.com and check out the all-new, all-in, as well as their beautiful hot sauna units available now for pre-order. It's been one of the best investments I've made in my health. I guarantee it.
In brick and mortar stores, they're not going to want their brands associated with this, right? It's like, you know, mom with her little kids at the checkout aisle, like they don't want to see the F word, yeah, you know, next to the candy or whatever.
How dare you?
Yeah. Exactly. And so it was like the publisher really struggled with it.
Yeah.
And to their credit, they went with it. But it's funny because back then it just seemed like such a plain decision about reach and audience. And I've only appreciated the depth of the repercussions, the brand repercussions, mm-hmm, really more recently, mm-hmm, like just in the last few years.
Yeah, I think that's fair. How many copies have you sold to date?
Of that book or all books?
That one book.
That one book, I think 16 million, 17 million. Can't complain. Like,
I mean, that's pretty incredible.
Can't complain.
Yeah, pretty incredible.
Yeah.
What do you think, if you could sort of net out three main core ideas from that book, what do you think really resonated and still continue to resonate? I mean, because it's still an evergreen. It's not out of style.
It's, yeah. And it, to be clear too, these three ideas that I'm going to share, like they're not my idea. Like these are thousands of years old. I just repackaged them really well.
Yeah. You and Ryan Holiday have stole from the great philosophers 2000 years ago. That's fair.
Yeah.
Robert Greene stole from.
This whole genre is just stealing.
Yeah.
I mean, I always tell people, I say that like, you know what self-help was called before self-help? It's called church. It's called philosophy.
Well, I mean,
and it's
there's so many, right?
Yeah.
It's like Tony Robbins in the 80s. You know, Picasso talked about this for.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's been around forever. But so, okay, the main three ideas. The first one is that in life, you never escape struggle. Like our mind plays this game with us that if I can just have X, then I'll be happy. If mm-hmm. I can just get a raise, then I'll be happy. If I can just buy a new house, then I'll be happy. And what we don't realize, we tend to only visualize the benefits of whatever we want. We don't envision the costs. And So we don't understand that, okay, yes, getting that new house will make you, it'll make you happy for a while. But then there are all sorts of drawbacks and problems of owning a bigger or nicer house that you're not thinking about right now. And then those are going to drive you crazy. And so then your brain's going to invent another thing that says, oh, if I can just have that, then I'll be happy.
Yeah. Never satiated.
Yeah. So that's the first idea, is that basically, like, we don't, improving your life is not getting rid of problems. It is upgrading and having better problems. And the problems never end. So that's idea number one. Idea number two is that you are responsible for everything in your life, because you are always choosing how to see and how to react to everything in your life.
Right.
And there's a section called the fault response, or the responsibility fault fallacy, which is, you know, most, a lot of people have a knee jerk reaction when they hear that. And they say, like, well, you know, my dad got cancer, and that's not, how is that my responsibility?
Or I was a victim of a senseless crime.
Right.
Yeah. Not fair.
Not fair. It's not my responsibility. You know, it's like, it's not your fault, but it's still your responsibility. Like, you still have to choose how to react to the cancer diagnosis. You have to choose how you're going to see it, think about it, respond to it.
This is a Stoic idea.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. Marcus Aurelius.
And so, yeah, you are always, in every moment, you are choosing what to pay attention to and how to react to it.
It's a good reminder.
Yeah. And then the third one is that most of our meaning, most of the meaning and value in our lives comes through suffering and sacrifice. So when you try to, not only is avoiding suffering and sacrifice kind of counter, like, ultimately impossible, but it's counterproductive in that you are robbing yourself of the chance to develop a deep sense of satisfaction and meaning. Like, we tend to, when you, each of us, when we look back over our lives, the things that most define us tend to be, like, the hardest things that we've overcome.
Right.
And so if you try to avoid overcoming hard things, then you never develop that deep sense of identity and satisfaction. And so we should confront hard things. And not only that, but confront the hard things we want. I've got a phrase that I repeat a lot in the book called choose your struggle. Right. Mm-hmm. It's like, you're going to have to struggle, so you might as well choose what you're struggling. That kind of combines all three of those concepts.
Yeah. You've read Viktor Frankl.
Yep.
So, I mean, themes from,
it's very much
history and, you know,
that component's very existentialist, you know, the responsibility piece is very Stoic. And then the struggling and happiness is very Buddhist. Mm-hmm. And those are like my philosophical roots, is Stoicism, Buddhism, and existentialism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's ironic, right? How, let's talk about that third piece, how we run away from pain, mm-hmm. or try to avoid it, right?
Yeah.
And yet it's so necessary. Even if you're in the weight room, you've got to literally tear muscle to build muscle.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen any other way.
And the brain, the mind functions in such a way that, like, you will find you have to find meaning somewhere, right? So if you remove all the struggle and suffering from your life, then the smallest inconvenience will strike you as extremely meaningful. So when you see people who, you know, just lose their shit in the grocery store over a coupon, or are, like, screaming at their kids over something completely inane, they're doing that not because, you know, they have these massive problems, challenges in their life that they're confronting. It's because they lack massive challenges in their life. Because they have no major challenge in their life, they see a rejected coupon at the grocery store as a massive challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you surround yourself with comfort, you lose perspective. You lose touch with reality, essentially.
Right. So how should we be looking at adversity when it punches us right in the face? You know, the Mike Tyson quote, I love it. You know, everyone has a plan till you get punched in the mouth.
Yeah.
Like, so what should we do when we get punched? Say thank you, may I have another?
Yeah. I mean, not necessarily. I think we have to be sober about it, right? And understand that there's no avoiding it. And ultimately, the best you can do is look for the punch that you want to have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a the difference between a good life and a bad life is a bad life is punching you in the face in a way you didn't choose, and a good life is punching you in the face in the way you did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you tried something that was difficult. Maybe you failed, but you also learned.
And you can always look back and say, and be proud of that attempt.
Yeah. And you were able to get back up and try again.
Yes.
And again and again.
And that's what builds self-esteem. That's what builds self-worth. That's what builds a sense of identity.
You've heard some of these stories, I'm sure. People have read the book and have changed their lives. Well, what's one of the most surprising things that's come as a result, like you didn't expect to happen?
Oh, man. I mean, there's been so many stories that I've heard. One of the, I'll just share a couple of like the more powerful ones that were pretty incredible. You know, when Syria was in the middle of its civil war, I still don't know how or why, but the book caught on there. And I started hearing from a lot of Syrian civilians caught in the middle of the war, and just telling me that the book was helping them get by, deal with it. I've heard from a lot of women from, I'll just say, parts of the world where women aren't treated very well.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them have said that it's inspired them to try to get away or forge a better path for themselves, to turn down maybe what their family or their community is pushing them into. I remember I was in Australia. I had a guy, it was really funny. I did an event, a speaking event in like Brisbane or Melbourne or something. And this old kind of man's man came up afterwards. He was probably in his 60s, you know, just looked like this old rugged, like a truck driver or something. Mm-hmm. And he just kind of stood there awkwardly, didn't say anything. And finally his wife came over and she was like, he wants to say something to you. And I could tell he could barely get the words out. And he said, he was like, 2 years ago, I got a cancer diagnosis. He said, I've never read a book in my life. And the whole time I was on chemo, I just read your book over and over again. And he just started like blubbering. And I was like, holy shit. I remember just giving him this like big burly man hug.
Yeah.
So there's some incredible stuff that comes out of it. It's the sort of thing you, like as an author, you can't even imagine where it ends up or whose hands it ends up in.
Yeah. I think that's curious too. Like I've noticed you just never know who's paying attention.
Yeah.
And that's, you ever think about this idea of the MVA, like minimum viable audience?
Mm-hmm.
Like yeah. How many people really need to like read your book or watch your videos or listen to your podcast for you to keep doing it? Like what is that minimum viable audience? What is it for you?
Oh. It's hard because like my baseline has gotten so scrambled and screwed up from building large audiences for so many years. You know, it's like I've reached the point that if I publish something and it fewer than 100,000 people read or watch it, I get upset, which is absurd. I'm 100% aware of how absurd that is.
Entitled.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, like it's, if we post something and only 90K engage with it, I'm like screaming in my Slack channel at my team.
It's a failure.
Yeah. But it's silly because it's, you know, I recognize that like that in and of itself is, you know, me from 15 years ago would have killed for that opportunity. And to have 90,000 people read or watch a thing I made.
Yeah.
And
you could more than almost double fill up Dodger Stadium with that many people.
Yeah. It's,
when you put it in context, like it's pretty wild, right?
It is wild.
I've had, you know, multiple millions of people watch one of my videos, and it's just thinking about that is mind blowing.
Yeah. It's,
let's shift gears a little bit, and use that, the metrics a little bit. You're playing a whole new game now. Like you're pivoting, you're rebranding, or at least you're leveling up. Something's happening.
Sure.
You're retooling. You're getting into the game. You're on YouTube big time.
Yep.
Talk to me about that. What's the strategy?
Two sides of it. One is I got extremely burnt out a couple years ago and took about 6 months off, really just kind of evaluating what do I want out of my life, my career?
Yeah.
What am I doing?
What am I doing here?
What am I doing? And I really realized that what I missed, I think doing so many big projects in traditional media, I mean, while they were great and I'm very proud of them, I didn't like the effect it had on me mentally or emotionally. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of pressure. Like, I mean, it's like, as you know, when a publisher or a studio shows up with a big contract and a big check,
yeah,
like they want a hit.
Yeah.
They don't want to screw around.
Right.
It's like, give us a hit. And that sort of pressure, for me, it just wasn't fun. Like it just put a lot of pressure and anxiety on me. And it didn't, like, I found myself really missing those days of creating content on the internet. Hey, let's try five things, throw it at the wall.
Yeah.
Two of them bomb, two of them do great. Awesome. We'll just keep doing the two that did great. Like, I missed that process a lot.
Yeah.
So I decided that I really wanted to come back to online content. And by this point too, the whole market had shifted, right? We were talking earlier about shifting market landscapes and seeing that the boulder that you're pushing down the hill is now up a hill, mm-hmm. and you've got to reorient yourself and find the new downhill.
Yeah.
And to me, it was just plainly obvious that it was video and podcasting were mm-hmm. like the two big growth opportunities.
Yeah. So in context of other people who are thinking about doing their content play, mm-hmm. whatever genre they're in, you know, whether that's you got a flower shop or mm-hmm. you're running an agency or you're a painter.
Yeah.
So what have you learned so far about creating content? Because your videos are popping off. You're getting traction.
I'm watching
you, cheering you on. I mean, you're hitting milestones.
Yeah.
Good things are happening.
Sure.
Of course, a lot of that's due to the fact that you've already invested. You got all this equity already out there in the market.
I have a massive tailwind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That said, you still have to show up.
Yeah.
And do the work.
Sure.
So what have you learned?
I've learned that I think video is, there's probably the most opportunity in video. It's also the hardest.
What's hard about it?
To do it at a very high level, you need some degree of a team.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of technical knowledge, a lot of equipment. It's expensive to get started. And it's also just time and labor intensive, right? It's editing, takes forever. Mm-hmm. So it's video, I feel like, is the high effort, high reward mm-hmm. avenue. Obviously, a lot of this is dependent on your market and what kind of content you want to make. But
yeah.
Just in generally speaking, video right now is high effort, high reward.
Yeah, but you're doing direct to camera stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like you have, I mean, it's probably scripted, I would assume.
I'm not building sets and,
yeah.
you know.
But it is direct to camera. Yeah. So it is, in our world, it's a low lift.
Yeah, yeah.
Like.
For sure.
Yeah.
I mean, the hardest stuff we do is just go outside with an iPhone and maybe talk to a couple people or something. That's been very rewarding for me personally. Like, I've enjoyed that learning curve. I kind of missed it.
Yeah.
Like I missed struggling with something, like mm-hmm. watching myself get better at it.
I also feel like you're all in on it.
I am.
So maybe that's the other lesson, is like, you can't sort of be half baked.
No.
On this, you've got to either,
yeah.
well, if you go half baked, you'll get half baked results.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, it's any creative field is highly, highly competitive. And so you can't part-time job it. Like
yeah.
it's, you really do have to go all in.
Who are you competing with, you think?
I mean, ultimately with myself, but I like to look at others as, like, as you said, the word you said, milestones, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, passing somebody in my industry and subscribers or views or whatever. Like, it's kind of like, it's a little pat on the back moment.
Yeah.
But it's not the reason.
Right. I mean, those should be taken with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
Right. Like,
it's fun. It's like,
Jay Shetty has 16 or 17 million followers. Jay Shetty will not ever be on this podcast because I'm not a fan.
Yeah.
I won't mind saying that in public.
Yeah, me neither.
But he has 16 million people who have raised their hand and said, I like you. So he's got that.
Yeah.
You know, good on him.
Yeah.
But you're carving out your own space.
Sure. So I guess you're asking, like, how am I defining success?
Or? Yeah. I want you to maybe impart some advice, because I know a lot of people are really getting that content game.
Yeah.
Because they see how valuable it is to build their brand. And I think when you, again, when you show up and you're distinct, mm-hmm. You stand for something.
Yeah.
You need to help create that brand, or else you either, you know, run the risk of being the generic brand, which no one cares about anyway.
Right.
All they care about is cost. So that's a commodity item that's forgotten. You show up in some forgotten aisle of Costco and, you know, you're not important or relevant.
Yeah.
Versus, like, yes, I do stand for something. I'm shaken, not stirred. I'm the tuxedo guy. I'm the hero of the story.
Yeah.
This is who I am. You can rely on me for this. I want to ask, like, what else have you learned? What advice can you impart as you're on this journey?
So it's anybody who wants to get into the content game, I think everybody struggles with this at some point, of not getting captured by the views and metrics.
Yeah. You fall into the vanity metric.
Yeah. Not, trap. Not, you know, making sure you stick by your values, and, also keep it fun. Like, you know, make sure you're making stuff that you're passionate about and mm-hmm. care about. I've always seen it as a Venn diagram. You know, like, there's one circle is the things I love, and then the other circle is the things the world loves, or right. the audience loves.
Yeah.
And you find that overlap and just try to live there. And if I'm ever going to get out of that overlap, just make sure I get out on the side of what I love, not on what the audience loves. Like,
right.
if you ever fall into the trap of just making things the audience loves and you don't, you're shooting yourself in the foot. Like, it's a short term, you're sacrificing longevity for a short term win.
Or you built your own prison.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I try to stay in that overlap. And in terms of the brand question, you know, understanding your side of that Venn diagram is really understanding your brand. It's like you said, what are my values? What do I stand for? What's the message I'm trying to get out into the world? And I personally think, like, every brand probably has a ceiling somewhere, just based on how many people are going to be interested in those ideas or values. And my goal is to, you know, establish the values and the ideas, and then just squeeze all the juice out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Try to hit the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm at the ceiling, great. Good job.
So who's it for? What you're doing, who's it for?
It's for myself primarily, and it's for everybody else secondarily.
Be more specific though. Like, who's the audience for what you're making?
It's generally, it's anybody who is going through a tough time in their life, who's mm-hmm. struggling with something, who's in pain, who wants to give fewer fucks.
Yeah.
You know, stressed out, anxious.
Yeah. You talk about a lot of emotional wellness things. You talk about therapy. You talk about relationships.
Yeah.
You're very candid about, you know, your prior dating life, and then, you know, your married life. And mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of people in this world that need that.
There's millions.
Yeah, we're all trying to navigate it.
Yeah. I mean, and all those things are interrelated. So I'm fortunate in that I've built a brand that casts a pretty wide net, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we joked about the chicken soup thing, but, like, there is a how to not give a fuck about silly things in a relationship, you know, mm-hmm. how to not give a fuck about silly things at work, how to not give a fuck about family drama. Like, it's, you can apply it almost anywhere.
Yeah. And so where's that going to take you? What's the next chapter look like?
So I really want to get very good at video. Like, that's the primary focus at the moment. I think there's the most opportunity is in video. I'm personally enjoying video the most at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Are you scripting it all out? You reading from a teleprompter, or mm-hmm. is it all right here?
No, it's definitely a teleprompter.
Yeah.
And
are you writing the script, so?
Yes. Yeah, I've experimented with hiring people to help with that, and it's just it's my superpower. So you can't really outsource that.
Yeah.
It's kind of the one thing I'm not really able to outsource.
Yeah. How about the kryptonite piece of that, the giving up control? Is that hard to do?
Sometimes. Yeah, sometimes. It's
what areas are you having difficulty? Like in the cuts, the edits, like, oh, that should stay in.
Yeah.
Not that. This not that.
Sometimes the edits, you know, what I've noticed with my team, and I imagine this generalizes towards any sort of creator business or content business, is that there's a certain, like, trust is extremely important. So yeah. I have people who have worked for me for many, many years, and I trust that, like, okay, if he's going to go edit this piece, this newsletter or whatever, he's going to do a good job and I probably don't have to look at it.
Yeah.
But it takes years to get to that point.
Right.
When somebody comes on and they're brand new, I think of it as in terms of like alignment, like aligning taste and vision. And
yeah.
It takes many, many months of feedback, back and forth, discussion to find somebody who can get on the same page with you.
Yeah. I feel the same way. It's like someone doesn't edit. It's like, I look like an idiot.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Why would you put that shot there?
Exactly. Like that's my, I have a double chin in that one. And it's like a lazy eye. It's like,
yeah. That's the problem with video too, though, is just like, we're the so critical of ourselves.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I can't watch it.
I mean, it's painful sometimes. It's just like, oh, yeah, do I really look like, do I laugh that way? Oh my God.
Yeah. All right. As we're sort of, rounding third, coming home, final, maybe parting words of advice for entrepreneurs, people trying to start new ventures, trying to do their thing. Mm-hmm. And this is maybe from, you know, your side of the house, the wheelhouse where you feel comfortable, which is sure. Maybe navigating the emotional side of things.
I would say just that. I generally find when I talk to entrepreneurs and founders and people in the business world, I find that they underestimate or don't even consider the emotional component of what they're doing, when actually, like, emotion is extremely practical. Like, if your work is fun or you're excited about it or you believe very deeply in it, it's an accelerant for everything. You're going to be able to work longer. You're going to be more resilient when problems show up. You're going to problem solve better. You're going to recruit talent easier. You know, everything is going to get 10, 20, 30% easier if yeah. you're emotionally aligned with what you're doing. And I just find that so many people don't, they just try to bury it. They try not to think about it.
I mean, we were just sitting back, you know, chopping it up, reminiscing about the good old days and all that, you know, tracking my roots, where I came from and where I'm going. But like I say, man, always said it, it's not about the destination, no. It's all about the journey.